Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being patient and sticking with us to the last panel of the afternoon. I promise we will end promptly, and now we are beginning promptly. At the suggestion, I think the very good suggestion, of Dan Mock, who's at the far left here, the members of the panel have by email colluded and agreed that instead of following the classic format of prepared statements, we will have a conversation, a good old-fashioned conversation, which I will try to moderate. In order to break the ice, as it were, among people, some of us whom have never met except by email, we're going to have each of the panelists introduce themselves, and then I will commence the conversation. Dan, this is responsibility is with you, so you begin by introducing yourself, please.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for staying this long. I'm Dan Mack. I'm the director of the ACLU Program on Freedom of Religion and Belief, which is the ACLU's national religion program.
Good afternoon. My name is Khalid Latif. I work as a university chaplain here at NYU. I'm also the executive director of NYU's Islamic Center, and I work as a chaplain for the NYPD.
I'm Marty Lederman. I am a professor at the Georgetown University Law Center. For the last 2 years, I was in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. But I should say right here that nothing I will say reflects the views of the Department of Justice. And I suspect that nothing I'm going to speak about today has anything to do with the matters that I worked on at the Department of Justice.
Noah Feldman. I teach law at Harvard and taught law here before that very happily for a long time.
David Lockman, I work for Congressman Gerald Nadler, in whose district you are now sitting. He's the chairman of the Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties of the House Judiciary Committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Harun Mogul. I'm executive director of Maidan Institute, which is a consultancy around Middle East and Muslim issues, and I'm also a PhD candidate at Columbia University.
Sam Raskoff. I teach law here at NYU.
So in the sort of preliminary conversations that we began to have on the email, one of the topics that immediately exploded and made me excited about this panel was the question of the relationship between the government and what happens within mosques and other religious organizations. And there have been some developments on the ground, as it were, in this area recently, and they have very serious and interesting legal implications that are directly connected to the themes of today. So I thought I would ask Sam to begin by talking a little bit, just very quickly, about the changes that he sees happening on the ground, and this draws on very much on Sam's prior experience as Director of Intelligence for the New York Police Department.
Thanks, Noah. I'd be glad to do that. The changes that I perceive are prominent in the area that's sometimes called counter-radicalization. This is a fairly new coinage, at least it's a new coinage in American security discourse. And it actually has a pedigree, this term does, in the programs that come along with it. And by and large, the pedigree is European, more specifically British. The idea behind counter-radicalization is roughly this. In keeping with the general kind of preemptive disposition of counterterrorism policy, in other words, the general logic that in order to be effective at counterterrorism, officials need to be out ahead of the threat, not reactive to explosions that have already taken place, the government essentially took upon itself to think about how to position official policy so as to intervene in a lot of different ways preemptively. But one of the ways it's chosen to intervene of late, especially in view of the emergence of the so-called homegrown threat about which we heard a little bit this morning, is to intervene in the ideational world of Muslims. The government has essentially taken it upon itself to begin to think about its role in relation to shaping the thought world of Muslims, up to and including Muslims in America. And I think that's, Noah, what's kind of most striking of late. The Obama administration has essentially been interested in these sorts of policies. It hasn't yet issued a clear public statement about where it intends to go, but in lots of different ways, in lots of different places, it's signaled its intention to do more of this intervention in the lives of Muslims. And I think, just to kind of get to a kind of take home about it, I think it's a worrisome trend at the level of law, specifically at the level of the Establishment Clause, which quintessentially prohibits the government from becoming a manager of religion, a manager of theology and religious institutions, I think it's also worrisome from the standpoint of strategy. I'm a skeptic about the efficacy of policies that are directed at trying to change people's religious worldviews.
Imam Khaled, I wonder if I could ask you, you're in a very interesting position here. You've been an imam on two college campuses. You're also chaplain of the police department of New York City. First of all, I guess my question is, have you seen any of this? Is this visible to you at all? Or when you hear Sam talk about this, do you think it doesn't match the visible reality, at least in the institutions you've been associated with or that you hear about?
I mean, I think realistically speaking, there isn't really that much of a tangible presence of it. I think when we speak about kind of counter-radicalization programming and things of that nature, you do see organizations and institutions to a certain extent in the Muslim community that are seemingly working with a governmental apparatus, but you know, I think the issue that's at hand is that there's not really that much radicalization that exists, if any at all, in our communities. And so when we begin to then speak about the effect or the impact of these programs, even if the programs are doing very little, you know, the aftermath of it is such that, you know, we've seemingly had this impact because this doesn't exist within our communities, but essentially didn't exist whether the program in and of itself was taking place or not. I think a lot more of what we see in the communities is not necessarily a kind of collaborative effort, but more of a hesitancy to work, that there's kind of
hesitancy between, on which side?
I think on both sides there's a certain hesitancy, because you see that there's people who are looking for Muslims to work with, and they're not necessarily meeting individuals who kind of get what they're trying to conceptualize behind a lot of these their efforts. Sorry. But at the same time, within the Muslim community, you have a lot of individuals who they're not as well versed in what's taking place, and their own kind of substantiated fears make them a little bit hesitant in working with governmental officials on a lot of these programs. I think also, before I keep going, just to follow suit, I'm not speaking on behalf of the NYPD in any way, shape, or form. So for the camera in the room and everybody else. But you know, it's a very tricky situation, because even if we look at New York as kind of a case study, you have highly ethnocentric populations that are made up of individuals who are very much so from immigrant backgrounds, many of them who, you know, they've started families here, but they're still not kind of well-versed in how things work here. And they're dealing with just the day-to-day anxieties that most individuals deal with. And now on top of that, they're dealing with a different level of scrutiny, and it makes it a little bit harder for them to kind of just manage all of their operations. And I apologize, I wasn't here for the sessions before, but given issues with funding and giving issues with, you know, a lack of financial stability through kind of secure financial muscles and these things, it makes it that much harder to establish real effective relationships, I think, with people who are saying, well, come and trust us, you know, we're going to make things better for you. I don't know if that makes sense.
Harun, do you agree that that the kind of things that Sam is talking about are not particularly visible to you, or do you have a different sense?
I think that building off of what the previous speaker said, a lot of Muslims speaking to me and elsewhere tend to feel two types of animosity. The first is a kind of diffused aggressiveness, and the second is microaggression, as a good friend of mine calls it. Microaggression is a little bit like death by a thousand cuts, and this diffused aggression, I think, comes from the fact that the larger framework or discursive framework that exists right now around Islam is both opposed to Islam and yet refuses to decide what Islam is. So when it's convenient, Islam is a race. When it's not convenient, Islam is not a race, because we're not racists. Islam can be a culture. Islam is a religion, but it's not the right kind of religion. It's a religion that needs to go under some kind of reform process, which will be affected by Fox News in their capacity as theological arbiters. And I think to that effect, I actually have a quote that I really want to read, which I think elucidates this kind of thinking. It's from Lynn Torgerson, who is the independent candidate for the 5th Congressional District in Minnesota. She ran against Keith Ellison, who is a Muslim member of Congress, wanted very much to defeat him. She was pretty much destroyed in the election, but her statement is, "I also am trying to teach people about the problems we have with the ideological political part of Islam as opposed to the religious part. Under the First Amendment, we of course have to allow them to worship the moon god Allah, but beyond that, Islam, also known as Sharia law, is not just a religion. A big part of it is the political ideology that is in conflict with our constitution, freedom of speech, equal protection for women, freedom of religion. So I think what I'm seeing is this kind of discourse is beginning to become more and more prominent, especially in the last 6 or 7 months, and is creating a sense of frustration among a lot of American Muslims individually and collectively because they're not really sure what they're up against. Because the discourse itself doesn't really know what it's trying to accomplish. Specifically, it's expressing a lot of grievances and prejudices without necessarily knowing where to go with them.
Sam, do you want to push back?
I don't want to push back on the idea that the perception of government within certain Muslim communities is as Haroon was just representing it. But I'm making, I think, a somewhat different point or trying to address a somewhat different phenomenon, which is the appetite on the part of officials, whether they're sitting in Washington or in New York or anywhere else, to intervene or to become much more energized in the active management of kind of Muslim ideation going on, as I said, within our country. I think we've always assumed that the U.S. government puts a thumb on the scale in favor of kind of preferred mainstream accounts of Islam overseas. Whether to do that is compliant with the First Amendment's Establishment Clause is itself a very kind of knotty issue. But no one would disagree that the Establishment Clause applies domestically. So the question is the government's recent turn to the active management of Islam consistent with the Establishment Clause and its values? And just to give you a couple of very specific examples before the others weigh in, the kind of phenomena I'm talking about when I talk about counter-radicalization really run the gamut. One end of the spectrum are kind of expressive interventions. And what do I mean by that? Well, sitting in this room in February of this year, John Brennan, who's the president's chief counterterrorism advisor, staked a claim, I believe in the presence of the imam, by the way, staked a claim at the invitation of the imam, if I'm not mistaken. He was the guest of the NYU MSA when he spoke. Staked a claim about the meaning of jihad and kind of spoke in the manner that President Bush spoke right after 9/11 about what jihad meant and what jihad doesn't mean and so forth. Those of you who heard Noah speak after lunch are aware of the kind of the tension when American, clearly non-Muslim officials become involved in the kind of normative assessment about religious concepts. That's one aspect of counter-radicalization, but it's not merely expressive. It's the FBI, it's Department of Homeland Security, it's the National Counterterrorism Center, and the entire apparatus of national security, which has become much more involved, up to including, I would say, at the New York City Police Department, much more involved in managing kind of Muslim community and up to and including, I would say, theological affairs.
So one thing that might be said here is that there are multiple constituencies here, and we've so far talked a little bit, Sam is talking about really intelligence officials, people within the U.S. government and the state governments. Then there are ordinary people who are encountering the kind of political discourse that Haroon was talking about. And then, of course, there are elected officials. So I wonder if I might turn to you, David, and ask whether what you see in your life and as a participant and a close observer of our political process as to the view of our elected officials, not necessarily your view or those of your boss, but the views in general of our elected officials on the question of what to do about, really essentially the question of what they're making of Islam, how they're thinking about Islam.
Well, there are 535 members of the House and Senate, so
it's sometimes possible to see trends. Nevertheless,
no, there are trends, and I didn't mean to be flip. But if I could take as a jumping-off point your observation earlier about the leap into open hostility, we certainly have seen within the Congress an undercurrent of hostility as we consider legislation, or as we consider even some of the surveillance policies, a very strong point of view among some members that this is a Muslim issue, that these national security issues are a Muslim issue, that they are a issue of the Arab-American population, and very, very focused on that. And there is certainly that strain. There are other members who very much view these as improper inquiries or improper conclusions from purported facts. But the extent to which it really exploded on the national scene was, I think you were correct, part of the election cycle, and if there was any doubt, certainly the blessed quiet we're enjoying right now is definitely an example of that. But we can, but I think the extent to which you know, the effort was made to identify the president as foreign and as Muslim, you know, to question his credentials both as an American and as a commander-in-chief, are indicative of that undercurrent that we've been dealing with that became very visible and very national around the Park 51 project, the project which is neither a mosque nor at Ground Zero. But so, and it's still there, and I would imagine under, thank you. All the years we've asked witnesses to pull the mic closer, and what do? The first time I sit down here. And I think with the new Republican regime, we are going to see oversight hearings, legislative efforts that will attempt to stir this pot further. I think that strain within the Republican Party is on the ascendancy, and so we're not nearly done with this yet.
Dan, do you? There obviously are civil liberties implications here. What do you? What seem like the most salient and important ones to you?
Well, I've seen much more hostility than I have seen governmental actions that are so pro-Muslim that they give rise to Establishment Clause concerns. I think it's, and this is not a response. I know that the point made earlier was more of a nuanced one, but there obviously is out there this notion, as I'm sure you've all have heard, that you know they're trying to impose Sharia law, and you know that's absurd on so many levels, but it's actually carried some weight, shockingly, you know, and as many of you know, this constitutional amendment was just passed in Oklahoma, which purported to ban the use of Sharia law by Oklahoma courts, and I think Stephen Colbert put it best when he said, "Just because something doesn't exist doesn't mean you can't ban it." but I do see that this is a serious problem, obviously, in New York and in many other places. The government officials who are confronted with a lot of these issues are doing the right thing. Another example is a situation that many of you, I'm sure, know about in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where there is a dispute about expanding an existing mosque to a much larger space, to an Islamic community center. All of the government officials that have any actual decision-making authority, as in New York, have had no hesitation about approving this. Nonetheless, there are a lot of groups out there locally, and they've come in nationally, to oppose this and to file all sorts of lawsuits and complaints with every local agency under the sun, doing whatever they can to stop this expansion. And as I said, the government officials who can do anything about it have all done the right thing so far. But it's gotten so bad even there, even where the local government has done the right thing, that one of the arguments being made in court and being aired in court, amazingly, is what was referred to before. Islam is not a religion. And that argument was taken so seriously that the Justice Department actually felt the need to file an amicus brief in the case saying, "We believe Islam is a religion," which is just absurd and disappointing and shocking. I'm not saying it was a disappointing decision that they made at Justice, because it may well have helped. I'm saying it's disappointing that anyone thought that was a brief that needed to be filed in this country, in this day and age.
Well, and significant in light of what Sam was starting to talk about. So I hope we'll circle back around to that. But that's actually, Dan, a perfect lead-in to the question I wanted to ask Marty, because you brought us into the courtroom. What is Marty, as you know from his job description, he's presently a law professor, but for 8 years in the 90s and then into the 2000s, and then for 2 years more recently, he worked in the Office of Legal Counsel, the office in the Department of Justice where the best lawyers in the government work and try to figure out what the Constitution actually requires with respect to executive branch action, and Marty's one of the best lawyers I know. I want to ask Marty, what is the state of the law here? And on a couple of questions in particular. So one on the kinds of things that Sam was talking about where the government might actually begin to try, by whatever means, covert or otherwise, to influence the views of ordinary Muslims. Second, on the broader questions of religious liberty and establishment that are frequently coming up in the context of construction projects, such as the one in Murfreesboro or the Park 51 project.
Thanks, Noah. Many of you were probably here this morning for the incitement panel, and Professor Newborn said, well, there's not much to say here. The law's pretty clear. And there didn't seem to be too much of a problem that needed to be addressed. Everyone agrees that advocacy of unlawful conduct cannot be the grounds of criminal sanction or other sanction by the government. There's really no dispute about that, even though there might be some pressure being brought to bear on that, and I'll talk about that a little more later. Well, similarly, in the area of the religion clauses that both Noah and I teach, a lot of you might be very familiar with areas of religion clause law that are very hotly contested, mostly on the establishment clause. What can the government do in terms of giving money to religious organizations and schools, vouchers? How can the government speak in terms of religiously, the Ten Commandments sorts of issues and the like? And those questions have split the courts and split public and split interest groups and academics for many decades. But on the other side of there are certain religion clause problems that seem to have been resolved, on which virtually everyone agrees, and they're those that, among those, are the ones that Noah has teed up. So for one, generally, although the court wasn't too fond of giving religious exemptions to religious believers under the Free Exercise Clause, both David and I worked with the Clinton administration and Congress to enact the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and RLUIPA, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000, to give free exercise exemptions to religious believers, including in the land use area. So including when local and or state zoning laws place a substantial burden on the religious exercise of institutions. Governments are required to grant exemptions to churches and other religious institutions in various context, and there's a lot of complication. And what was remarkable is that there was an extraordinary consensus on this free exercise notion, and on two related notions. One is the one that Sam raised, which is the idea that the government cannot possibly be getting involved in discerning or articulating religious truth. The government simply doesn't have any jurisdiction to do so, nor any expertise in figuring out what is true Islam or Christianity or anything else. And that's a proposition that is quite well settled. There's no case law going the other way. And also, and perhaps most well settled of all, is the notion that whatever else one might think about the religion clauses, and I'll quote from Justice O'Connor here, but on this she at one point spoke for all the justices of the court. We have said time and again that the government generally may not treat people differently based on the god or gods they worship or don't worship. The clearest command of the Establishment Clause is that one religious denomination cannot be officially preferred over another. Or as the court held in a much earlier case in 1968, even more pointedly, and this gets to Sam's point, the state may not be hostile to any religion or the advocacy of any religion, and may not aid, foster, or promote one religion or religious theory against another, or even against the militant opposite. So these are very well established. That is a prohibition on sect discrimination is the one thing everyone agreed on. And I think there are beginning to be fissures in this. I think the case law is still very much there, but there's signs that there's danger on the horizon, possible danger on the horizon. And I'll just give a couple of examples of that, and then later in the discussion, we can try to apply that to various different problems that are arising. One is that in one of the most recent Ten Commandments cases involving McCreary County, Kentucky, in a concurrence, Justice Scalia, joined by the Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Thomas, suggested that at least when the government is speaking, in fact, the sect discrimination rule doesn't apply. The government may prefer monotheistic religions to all other religions. And he mentions Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. He goes out of his way to say, even the Islamic faith agrees that God gave Moses the commandments, and they were supposed to be the law upon which the people should act. And so this is the first instance in at least modern Supreme Court history where any justices suggested that sect discrimination would be okay, in, at least in certain contexts. Similarly, there have been some lower court cases and some cases that haven't gotten as much publicity that really involve this going on. So for instance, in the Fourth Circuit, one Virginia locality had a rotation of local ministers, priests, rabbis, and the like, who were invited to come in and give the invocation or the prayer before legislative sessions. And a member of the Wiccan church, a Wiccan minister, came and she applied and she was qualified and she was next on the list and they wouldn't let her give the invocation. And she sued, and the Fourth Circuit, without much explanation, said, she's a Wiccan. We're not going to allow that. And the Supreme Court denied cert on that. Similarly, in a Supreme Court case from two terms ago, disclosure, I represented this church, the Sumum Church. I'm sure you're all familiar with them. There was a locality in Utah that had put up Ten Commandment monuments. And the Sumum Church came in and said, well, you know, you can't discriminate one religion against another. We don't want you to take those down. We want you to put up our monument of our seven aphorisms, which include, the famous aphorism that everything vibrates. And they were denied.
That's not an aphorism, that's just a fact.
It's a very scientific religion, actually. And it's the fourth law of thermodynamics. And they went to the Supreme Court on a free speech ground, not on an Establishment Clause theory. And the court rejected the Sumum claim 9-0 on a theory that's not relevant here. But most importantly, in those latter two cases, I want to bring this up. It's relevant to this great coalition that David and I were part of. We were in the government, but during this free exercise coalition in the 90s, President Clinton brought together groups from the very far left to the very far right. Everyone was committed and solid around these ideals, free exercise and non-discrimination. But when these cases have come up, most of the organized religious groups have just been silent. When it comes time to actually supporting the free exercise rights of minority religions rather than traditional religions, there's been a deafening silence, and that silence in the so-called Ground Zero mosque case has become something more troubling when you have the Anti-Defamation League of all institutions coming out and suggesting not that the owners of that property don't have the right to put down to raise their building, but that they should choose something else. And so this consensus is breaking down both within the courts and in the religious community, I think, which might have implications for several of these practical issues.
But Marty, can I engage you on the law just for a moment? Because you said it's very clear, but there's a problem that it's a professional disadvantage of our job, of constitutional law professors. We walk around saying that things are clear because the law on the books looks clear. But then reality looks nothing like that. So you say nothing could be clearer. Nine justices agree, that's sort of like a catchphrase for constitutional law professors, that you know the government can't prefer one sect to another or say what religion means. But as Sam pointed out, a U.S. government official, in pursuance of his official duties, stood right here 6 months ago and said what Islam meant. When President George W. Bush said what Islam meant, he was doing so in pursuance of his official duties. That was not some private statement on his part. It's not as though you could make the claim, doubtful though it may be, that when there's an invocation when the president is inaugurated, that's sort of a private ceremony that takes place on the periphery of the ceremony which the whole country is watching, where he becomes president of the United States. So, I mean, that's a sort of preposterous claim, but people make it. Here, you can't even say that, right? I mean, he was being president when he said those words. Similarly, and I want to ask you about this, Khalid, as well, you know, institutions in the United States have chaplains. So in the case you mentioned, there was an official prayer affiliated with a legislative body. The New York City Police Department is a state actor under the terms of the Constitution. It's the government of the city. And it has not only you, Khalid, but other chaplains as well. So first I just want to ask Marty just to say whether you think our kind of constitutional lawyers' view that the law is clear actually corresponds to reality. I'll just put my cards on the table. I don't think it does. And then I want to ask Imam Khalid about his own experiences as someone who is affiliated with a government entity and is affiliated in a religious capacity.
In short, I mean, no, I do agree that even where the doctrine is clear and even where most scholars and judges and public interest groups happen to agree on a proposition of constitutional law. Of course, application is never uniform or consistent with that. But I do think it's notable, and again, I'm not going to opine on whether John Brennan was violating the Constitution here. But I think it is striking. I mean, Sam is right. This is new. Before George Bush and John Brennan got up and said Islam means X or does not mean Y, do any of you recall instances in which high government officials were getting up in public and explaining what true Christianity was and what false Christianity was? I mean, it is, I think, something new. Now, having said that, I think in the area of literal government official speech, that is to say, government actors getting up and talking.
And only constitutional law professors would have to draw a distinction between government speech and government speaking.
Correct. Right? Because there's this whole...
And yet that is a distinction.
There's this whole elaborate doctrine about all sorts of other things the government does that gets labeled government speech, and you don't want to even know about that. But this is literally government officials speaking. The courts have tended to stay out of those disputes. They don't get litigated very much. But I do think this is, that's what I'm saying. I think, Noah, this is sort of the foot in the door of something quite new.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. I do a lot of consultations for universities around the country. It's a new phenomenon to have a Muslim chaplain at universities in the country. When I actually started here, a lot of my parents' friends thought I became Christian, and they were like, why are you becoming a chaplain? I was like, do I look like I'm Christian? But when I do these consultations at state universities, one of the immediate things that they say is we can't pay for a chaplain because we are a state school. And my response is I work for the NYPD and I'm salaried through the NYPD. And they don't seem to have a problem with that. And I do think that a lot of the time we tend to kind of gloss over a lot of these things that are actually taking place. I can see where it would be problematic to have, the state influence how one would perceive a religion to actually be, or say that a religion is X, Y, or Z things. But at the same time, I think there's a certain advantage, as well as it opens a door to disadvantage for allowing certain groups in, and at the same time, not letting other groups in. You know, aside from my work with NYPD, I do a lot of work with the State Department, and they send me on State Department funding to different countries throughout the world, and I think they're influencing religion and what Islam means in a different way, because not only am I going as an American Muslim to predominantly Muslim communities in places like Sri Lanka and the Maldives, etc., and they're meeting me as an American Muslim for the first time, I'm also sometimes one of the first Americans that they've met, and within that it becomes kind of a different way to subtly say this is what Islam should be, or this is how we understand Islam to be, because we're picking who the Muslims are that we want to send to you that actually represent the way Islam functions in our country.
So Dan, can I just ask, Dan, Imam Khalid says, and I think he's absolutely right, part of the reason the NYPD hires him, part of the reason the U.S. government, with your taxpayers' dollars, sends him around the world is to advocate a view of Islam. So is that, in your view, is that or ought that to be constitutional?
I think there are some constitutional problems with governments hiring chaplains, whatever their aim. I think there are certain contexts where that's more or less true. I think when you're in a situation where there are people who don't have access to their faith leaders, that, for example, in prison, that might be a reason for the government to get involved, at least to supply. And I'm not suggesting that you're not doing any good work, but I do have some concerns.
You want to be less polite and indirect about that?
Not really.
I would just. Which of your fellow panelists is unconstitutional? Right?
I feel like there's a lot of questions around my constitutionality right now, and I'd like to be able to keep my job at NYPD. So if we can focus just on the Muslim Islam issue, that would probably be great.
I mean, I guess what I would say. All right. Well, let me ask a related question, Haroon. I want to ask you this question. So, you're a among other things a Muslim public intellectual. I think you've received many awards for exactly that description. So that means part of what you do is speak in various public venues about the multiple contested meanings of Islam and express sometimes your views on those topics. What's your view on the participation, as it were, of governments, the US, European governments, SAMHSA, this is a European model, in your business, as it were, your avocation and the thing that you do with your professional life?
So I actually think that under President Obama, this has actually accelerated quite a bit. And he's, or at least initially, until everyone assumed he was actually a Muslim, he assumed a much more proactive role. And one of the most interesting things that he's been doing is, you know, attempting to engage in a soft diplomacy with the Muslim world. And one of these initiatives, which is very interesting, is basically through State Department building networks linking Muslim leaders. So what they're actually trying to do, and they'll say they're doing, so persons such as Farah Pandit, for example, Rashad Hussain, who is the U.S.'s envoy or ambassador to the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC, they say that there's no difference between a Muslim in Sao Paulo and a Muslim in Rawalpindi, Pakistan, and we want to link them. They'll have good ideas, they should talk to each other, they should learn from each other. So the United States is getting into the business, basically, of building networks of acceptable Muslim intellectuals, and then empowering them with a certain amount of information or skills or whatever to pursue their agendas. And obviously these agendas are for whatever reason, seen to conform with foreign policy objectives. And I think just as a note on that, one thing that's very interesting is Rashad Hussain, and he's a very nice guy, he's what's known in Arabic as a Hafiz Qur'an. He's someone who's memorized the whole Qur'an, the Muslim holy text. So that's a very distinguished status within traditional Muslim communities. And one of the reasons I'm sure he's picked is because he has this status. He has this title to his name. And what the U.S. is really doing at this point is basically saying, we are part of a global Muslim conversation. We want to be in the room when people are having these conversations and deciding what religion is and is not. And I don't know if I would say that this is setting a precedent, but I agree with the points raised previously that presidents hadn't been saying this before. And the question becomes really, especially considering the elections of a few days ago, what happens if we have another president who begins to opine on the suitability of certain Christian doctrine or Jewish doctrine or what have you? Because certainly a door has been opened. And I think it is problematic that the conversation is not shaped around foreign policy and economics, but around Muslims as Muslims.
Leaving aside, though, Haroon, the question of its legal advisability, what do you think about the contributions that are or are not being made substantively? Do you think in general that the contribution is a positive one, a negative one? I mean, you know, one of the things that Imam Khalid just mentioned his trips on behalf of the State Department. Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf made the point repeatedly when he was being criticized in association with the Park 51 that he had been, I think, on 7 State Department trips in recent years, doing, as it were, the work of the taxpayers at the taxpayers' bill. So what kind of a job in general is the U.S. government doing on these questions from your perspective?
I think in the short term, it's very positive. This kind of cultural diplomacy is a good thing. Telling people how to engage in positive work, empowering NGOs, I mean, these are all good things. I hope we can all agree on that. I do think that there are a couple of problems, though, which may manifest in the long term. The first is that by intervening in these kind of debates, we become part of them, and you know that's for better or for worse. The second problem, and I think this relates to some of the questions that were raised in earlier panels, is we're assuming that the reason that terrorism exists is because of religion. This is an implicit assumption that the problem is in religious discourse. So we need religious leaders to go tell Muslims what they should be and shouldn't be, and that will fix the problem. And whether or not you agree with that view or that explains part of the problem, it does take a certain amount of attention away from economics, from policy, and more, I guess, shall we say, media or substantive issues, which may have more salience. It also puts us in the strange position of beginning to compete with or perhaps accelerate certain types of competition. So governments such as Iran, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia will fund their own view of religion. And now we're playing that game too. We're basically competing with Iran and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan in advancing a certain vision of Islam. Whether or not that's a good thing to do, in the short term, I think it is a good thing to do, but I think in the long term, we should have our eyes very wide open in terms of where it can take us.
You wanted to get in something to, and you should feel free to do that, and then I'm going to swing back around to Sam and David.
Sure. Just one small point to illustrate. I think the same thing that Sam brought up and others have talked about, that the dangers of the government saying this is the good version of this religion and this is the bad version of religion. I think one thing that was very admirable that happened surrounding the Part 51 controversy is, I agree with your comments earlier that Mayor Bloomberg said many forceful things about religious liberty and the importance of tolerance and diversity and all the rest. But as I recall, he and other government officials took pains not to take the extra step. Some of them did, but some of them didn't, to say, and this particular group, or the folks involved in this particular center, are those who speak on the good side of Islam. They are speaking for peace. We have used them internationally, and they are good ambassadors. I heard a number of government officials say very, at least to my ears, something that was pleasing, which is, it doesn't matter. Now, I think there are many other voices that can chime in this debate and attack the many lies of, that were thrown around about what the folks involved in Part 51 do believe or don't believe. I think that was a smear campaign, absolutely. But from a legal standpoint, from what the government should and shouldn't say, I thought it was very helpful that they said, we don't care whether these are good Muslims or bad Muslims. First of all, there's no such thing. And second of all, they have a right to do it. And I think that was very helpful, and the converse would have been troubling.
David, was that good politics?
Was it good politics? It depends where you sit. One thing we noticed was that the further you got from Lower Manhattan, the more vituperative and hostile the discussion became. And
wasn't that also a partisan question?
It was to some degree, yes, a very partisan question. People felt they had a good issue because the president is a radical Muslim and an atheist, and because and a communist. Yeah, I forgot. He's a communist and a fascist and a corporatist.
That's all consistent with Islam not being a religion.
Well, no, absolutely, and with being a bad religion except when it's good. And you know, whenever I talk about this, I always feel like I'm channeling George Wallace and blaming outside agitators for the entire problem. But you know, there is a certain sense in which you know, there are people outside New York who found this to be a great issue and it polled really well. But I'd like to get back to what Dan said, because the issue really does come down to not whether or not it's a good religion, it's a bad religion, whether this is a good or a bad religious leader, what his beliefs are, what his views are, is he radical, whatever that means, is he not radical, whatever that means. Congressman Nadler, who actually represents the site, and the World Trade Center site, and the Park 51 site, and even the strip club site up the street.
Oh, he doesn't prefer any sect to any other.
Not at all. And you know, gay goes on the hay. But you know, was very clear, and not surprisingly, I think this is the appropriate approach, that it is not for a government official to say whether or not it's a good idea, it's a bad idea, it's an appropriate place for it, it's not appropriate, an appropriate place for it. That is simply not something that the official universe should ever get into. So he would articulate the First Amendment issue and the RLUIPA issue, but he would not go the extra step to say, but they should or should not build it here or some other place, or how large will the Muslim free zone in Lower Manhattan get to be, which is really what the debate was about. You know, what's too, well, evidently Murfreesboro is too close. But you know, it was a sometimes difficult position to articulate because people wanted, you know, the answer. Are you for it or against it? And he said, no, I'm a government official. I don't get to say that, and I don't get to say, you know, based on what this particular person's preachings are or beliefs are, whether or not they do have that free exercise right.
I mean, I think, you know, Congressman Nadler gets good points from the ACLU for that position, but with respect to the bigger picture question of what happens in politics, not clear that that's the right strategy. I mean, insofar as Marty points out, as a matter of straightforward constitutional doctrine, there's no Supreme Court holding prohibiting him from speaking on these topics. Most elected officials and wannabe elected officials in the country, as you say, the further from New York, the more likely, were eagerly weighing in on it. And one possible thing that can happen is if those who support the appropriateness, I don't just mean the right, but the appropriateness of the community center at Park 51, the Park 51 site,
feel, coincidentally, given their politics, that they can't say that publicly, that also clears the space for the only people to be expressing who are expressing a view to be the ones saying that it's a bad idea, who obviously don't share that interpretation of the constitutional obligations of members of the government. So there really is a trade-off there. It's a delicate trade-off.
It is a trade-off. Obviously, there were different voices within that debate approaching it from different angles, and I think the responses to some of the discussions about the imam and some of the allegations, you know, were important contributions. There definitely is a trade-off. You also can't have the chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee, like, saying anything else, because... I hate to say that, but I don't know who is about to become
the chairman of that subcommittee, but my bet is whoever it is about to be fully prepared to say those things. Who is about to become the chairman?
That's a good question. Given the lineup, I'm not sure I'll be happy with any of them. I spent 12 years in the minority, and it wasn't pretty, and, you know,
yeah.
I've won and lost, and winning is better.
Yeah.
But we'll do what we have to do. And it's the debate
I'm just
will
making,
be joined.
Yeah, I'm just making the point that the view that you express, which, you know, it's a perfectly respectable view, and
I think it
may well be the right one, does represent one specific image of to what extent mm-hmm. Officials of the government can weigh in on religious questions. So that's a good lead-in, Sam, to sort of circle back to your view. So I think, just to set some common ground, I think the panel, more or less now, there is pretty broad consensus that things that implicate the kinds of issues you're talking about are happening. That there is, as Haroon says, public discourse about Islam in which U.S. government, either officials or people supported by the U.S. government, are participating. There are, in some cases, paid government officials who have the job of interpreting Islam. That's part of the job of an imam. It should be part of the job of an imam. There are constitutional worries about this from some perspectives. But there are lots of people who don't see a constitutional problem with it. What's your view on this? You described the situation to us, but you didn't really tell us very strongly what you thought about it.
Well, let me migrate from the strictly doctrinal constitutional to the strategic. In this case, I actually don't see the two as being different. Really, I think they're mutually reinforcing. But let me make my points in the language of the strategic.
Whose strategy, indeed?
Well, you're about to hear. So, counter-radicalization. I mean, we could talk about it in the terms of the Supreme Court's precedents on preferences for this or that sect within a kind of intramural debate going on in a religious tradition, but I like to think of it at the same time in terms of efficacy. So counter-radicalization implies some account of radicalization. You've already heard from some of the panelists that the social science on radicalization is, to put it mildly, not airtight. In fact, it's really just beginning. Now, that's not to say that somewhere down the line progress can't be made, but let's just kind of be aware of what we're talking about. We're talking about a kind of predictive social science that has bite at the level of trying to explain who among certain populations, and let's not mince words here, we're talking by and large about young Muslim men, who among them are most likely to go down a path that will culminate in violence and why. So I think the social science on that is incredibly immature at this point. The second point I would make is a point about counter-radicalization and about official policies that are directed at trying to address these trends. And that they're basically, at this point, I think it's an open question as to whether or not they can be effective. Why? Well, for many of the reasons we've talked about thus far. In addition to the fact that John Brennan may be transgressing the First Amendment when he gives his speech in this room 6 months ago, I think it's also a very dubious efficacy for John Brennan to kind of have a view about what jihad does or doesn't mean. I mean, I would actually want to know from the imam or from Haroon, sorry for singling you guys out, but you're our kind of Muslim members of the panel, you know, what you make of it when an American counterterrorism official kind of speechifies in that kind of area. But I think there are very profound questions about credibility. I think there are profound questions about knowledge, even kind of setting aside the question about credibility. Where is the government's knowledge base about Islam coming from? I mean, it's wonderful that Hafiz Quran is serving in the capacity as ambassador to OIC. It's especially wonderful because he's a graduate of the Yale Law School, but not, you know, kind of a good second-rate law school anyway. But let's face it. I mean, who chose him for the job, and how many are there like him, and exactly what are his views down the line? And I would say the same of Farah Pandit or any of the other officials who are serving in kind of official Muslim capacities. The last thing I would say, echoing a critique that's been made against counter-radicalization programs in the United Kingdom, is what does counter-radicalization, what do these official efforts do to the relationship between the government and Muslims? I mean, a term that you often hear in the discourse about the PREVENT program in the UK, which is the analog to American counter-radicalization, is that the program has the tendency to, quote-unquote, securitize the relationship between Muslims and the state, which is just a kind of highfalutin talk for the state now regards Muslims, especially young Muslim men, as potential two bombers, or else as potential antidotes to the phenomenon that gives rise to two bombers. So whichever way you look at it, the lens through which the state interacts with its Muslim citizens is dominated by the concept, by the discourse, and by the end goals of security, which I think is something that we ought to be worried about.
Harun, do you want to weigh in on that?
So I think actually it's, and this is one of the problems, is it's impossible to have a conversation on this topic at some level, right? So if John Brennan comes up to me and says, Harun, this is what I think jihad is, I'm not talking to John Brennan, I'm talking to a representative of the most powerful government that has ever existed. I am a graduate student. Right, so in the resource battle, right, I don't really count, and that's a fact, and this is a problem insofar as it can compromise actually positive engagements with the tradition, because if that engagement with the Muslim tradition is seen as being somehow sponsored by the U.S. government, then its efficacy or relevance to the wider Muslim world is lost. But I think it's also just a question of how does one really have a conversation with a representative of a government? And I think this kind of goes back to the earlier topic of that we were getting to, is that American Muslims, and especially American Muslim males, do feel quite intimidated to sort of get into certain topics or certain questions. We don't know, as we heard in the previous panel, what the consequences of certain statements may be. We just don't understand what could happen to us. And I don't mean purely in a legal sense, I mean in a professional sense, in a reputational sense. We've seen what's happened to Imam Faisal, who is a rather liberal and
far left,
you know, yeah, very, very far left, actually, exactly, Imam, who was simply savaged in the media for a period of several months, and while people did come to his defense, they really couldn't defend him in an adequate way. So it does, I think, complicate the position of American Muslims and goes back to that, I guess, feeling of frustration.
But Harun, can I just ask you about that? I mean, there are two different things you just pointed to, and they're both significant. The second one, the kind of capacity of the media to make anybody, I mean, I think honestly, if you had to try to pick the most, I'm trying to find the right word to describe this, you know, the most moderately tempered, liberal, peace-loving to the point of naivete imam, you know, in America, mm-hmm. everyone would probably agree that it was Imam Faisal. And yet, if it could happen to him, it really could happen to anybody. So I get that point, and I think you're right to raise it. But the first point that you made about dealing with the government, you said, well, you know, I'm talking to a representative of the U.S. government. He's the representative of the most powerful government on earth. I'm a graduate student. But when you actually talk to people who work for the most powerful government on earth, it turns out they're just people. Mm-hmm. And you actually have a huge advantage in that conversation on the topic of what is the meaning of Islam, mm-hmm. i.e. you know something about it, which he does not. And, you know, I think that's not a trivial difference. And I would just add to that the point that he, at least in a private conversation, will want to know. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I think is a constant issue for, you mentioned that you're a graduate student, that's why I'm mentioning this, constant issue for academics when dealing with government. Most academics addressing government start exactly where you do. They think, well, government is about power, and I'm just an academic, so, you know, what impact could I possibly have? But of course, it turns out that the minute the door is closed, all that government officials want from academics is some information that they can use to enhance their power. And if you give them that information, now you are fully participating in power. Now, that may be unethical. It's certainly something to be ethically nervous about. But I would push back on the claim that one has no power in that interaction. I think actually you have quite a bit of power in that interaction, assuming you want to use it, which is, as I say, a separate question.
I could see that the knowledge of Islam does give an edge considering the quality of conversation around Islam, which tends to be pretty poor in media and in general, I think. There's not that much information about Islam. But I do think that one of the problems really is understanding where that boundary is. You know, in a private conversation, I can be very helpful. And I can provide perspective and engagement, but in a public conversation that then becomes complicated by how the media will perceive something, how different forms of media will perceive something, how an academic audience will perceive something, and how government will perceive something. And I think being a Muslim male certainly complicates that, because there is a feeling of existential insecurity that comes with that topic, which makes it harder to speak to it. And I think that's what I'm getting to. I don't think that any that most Muslims in the United States are in imminent danger, but there is definitely a feeling of being somewhat unsettled. To an extent that is unusual for a lot of American Muslims, who, especially those of immigrant origin, who are more professionally, I think, successful and not used to this kind of attention. And so that very unsettledness creates an instability that becomes harder to use that kind of power.
Sorry, can I say one thing on that, too?
Really? Please, quickly. By all means, yeah.
I mean, I think also, though, you know, Haroon and I sitting at the table can say things to the effect of, John Brennan spoke to us 6 months ago. I think the likelihood of a young Muslim man also being able to have access to those conversations is not very likely. And the actuality of the situation is such that even a lot of these governmental institutions and individuals who are working in the government, they're not getting their information from necessarily well-credentialed sources. I think it's more so people go to speak to individuals to get their information for legitimacy and kind of a removal of accountability. It's that I've spoken to somebody who told me that this word means this, and I didn't know any better, so what else can I do? You know, I when I was in Colombo a few months ago, I was sitting with people from the Department of Defense, people from the State Department, and there was a woman who was there who was debriefing them on the movements that existed within the Muslim community of Sri Lanka, and she was just defining words wrong. You know, she said, this is what a Salafi is, this is what a Diobandi is, this is what the Tabligh Jamaat is, you know, throwing out a lot of words that were not English words that there was already an unfamiliarity with, and giving definitive meanings that were very different from what the actual technical meanings were. And, you know, so
what'd you do?
I said, you're wrong. Right? And, you know, she's like, what do you mean? And, you know, this is a woman who also is twice, thrice my age, who is running her own nonprofit and is regularly interfacing with the government. And here's this kid from New York City who's like, I think you're making a big mistake. But the likelihood of that scenario playing itself out day in and day out, where there are people who are working for the government, just by chance, there's a Muslim who actually has the audacity to speak up and say, you know, you're actually telling them things that are very misinformed, is very, very low. So that can't be a solution to it. And, I think it's a huge, you know, it should be emphasized even further what is being said at the other end of the table. You know, John Brennan was here speaking on an event we did with the White House Office of Public Engagement. And a week later, I'm flying into the country from an international visit, and I'm detained for 6 hours coming into the country. And so, again, the actuality of the situation is, you know, you're saying young men are looked at as either root causes or antidotes. Sometimes we're looked at both. Yeah. You know, we're the same in one. And it's, I think it kind of points to the idea that people don't really know what's going on, and a lot of it's rooted in this idea that the knowledge base they have is just full of misinformation.
I mean, I think it's impossible to emphasize that point too much. I mean, I have to say, from my limited experience in the U.S. government working on these issues, what's surprising is not actually to encounter somebody providing inaccurate information about some aspect of Islamic life. What is unusual is to see accurate information being depicted on such things. Actually, I mean, if you meet someone in the government who actually defines, if you show me someone in the government who could define Diobandi, Tablighi Jamaat, and Salafi accurately, I would be so amazed to meet that person that I would think, wow, that person's, you know, got no future in this government.
You know, but the problem with this is that, you know, I'm sitting with guys who are military men here on this trip as a security detail, and they're like, you know, you're so much better than these radicals who are here. And I was like, who are the radicals? Like, I met a ton of people who were living in, you know, you have tons of populations in this country of internally displaced peoples who are just trying to build stability, and they've been afflicted by tsunamis and all kinds of things that we can't imagine if we went through what we would do. And just with, you know, one sentence of misinformation, the entire population is labeled as being something that is radicalized. And I think to echo Haroon's point, that once they've been labeled that, everything that they come with is just dismissed. So it doesn't then matter if they don't have homes to live in or access to clean water or medicine or any of these other issues that they're actually experiencing, because we were told that because of their theological and legal interpretations of their own religion, you know, there's something that are radicalized, and you know, we're just going to forget about everything else in terms of their needs.
Khaled raises a very important point here that I want to turn to now, and that is the question of the global nature of these conversations. So in your description, you're sitting there with U.S. military people, but you're in Colombo, and you're talking about conversations that they're having and that others are having with people in Colombo. There's an NGO person who probably moves from capital to capital. These are increasingly globalized conversations. I'm wondering, Marty, I know you have to leave a bit early. I'm wondering whether you have a view about the legal differences between the U.S. government taking a role in the shaping of domestic conversations versus global conversations, first of all. And second, and this is asking you not to describe the law, but to make some predictions about the future directions of the law, whether you think that free speech issues in this country are likely to be affected by the global nature of these conversations. And that the example of this that I would just mention is the phenomenon of differential effects around the world of action taken here. So that if someone burns the Quran here, what they're doing may not qualify as incitement if nobody around them is about to respond with a riot. But if the news of that information could cause others to riot, and by the way, I don't assume that would be Muslims, could be non-Muslims elsewhere. It could be, you know, people, Hindus in India who would use it as an excuse to riot against Muslims. I mean, I'm just hypothesizing any one example. Whether you think in the long run our courts will become more open than they have been thus far to considering the global context when they make determinations of what constitutes free speech.
Thanks, Noah. Yeah, I'm going to have to leave in about 10 or 15 minutes. I apologize for that. But those are hard questions. The first one isn't so hard to describe where the law is, and that is, can the government, even if Sam is correct, that at least doctrinally, the government is not supposed to be taking a view on the truth of religious questions within the United States, whether it's doing so or not. There is more of a tradition, not a very prominent one, but a tradition of the United States trying to affect religious developments overseas, in particular to try to affect what young Muslim men are doing in the Middle East through various different efforts, some of which have been described here today. The case law on this, there's one case on it. It's from the Second Circuit. It's from about 20 years ago, called Lamont. And it suggests, without deciding, that that might be an Establishment Clause violation because the United States government and all U.S. governments do not have any insight into religious truth. They can't. The Constitution is supposed to disqualify them from having any positions on this. I think that the law, if it's ever litigated on this, will begin to change because of the practicalities of foreign relations, and in particular because I think the U.S. government will not be purporting to actually know the truth about religion, but its foreign affairs objectives will be quite transparent and manifest. And that is to say, it will almost be simply saying, look, we know there are various different philosophies associated with this religion. The world will be a better place if one triumphs and the other is defeated, and therefore we're promoting that one, not because we think it's religious truth, but because we think that global justice and peace will more likely follow. And of course, I think the courts would be sympathetic to
that.
Right,
I mean, one thing, this is a fascinating point. I mean, one thing that's intriguing about that is, historically, the establishment of religion was not adopted by governments because they believed in the religion. Right, the history of the establishment of religion is governments controlling religion to serve their own political ends. So ironically, under the secular purpose model, historically, you know, government establishments of religion always had a secular purpose. I mean, some people even said this explicitly. You know, the philosopher David Hume said that it was a really good idea to have an established
religion, establish government religion, because otherwise people would start believing in religion. So what you wanted to do was sap religion of all of its vitality, and the way to do that is put government bureaucrats in charge of it. So it is quite interesting that I think you're right to say there might be some sympathy, but it would be an interesting reversal of the historical meaning. But I also wanted to ask you about the free speech issue, because Steve Breyer, Justice Breyer, made a kind of spontaneous comment in an interview that he was doing, I think it was a TV interview, promoting his book, where he mentioned the globalized context. He's a very global guy. He's always traveling around the world and going to conferences talking about globalization. He mentioned the global context of free speech cases in the context of Quran burning, and he was criticized by various people for doing that. But I wonder if you thought there was some indication there that this was the leading edge of a changed view.
You know, it's a great question, and I was going to answer the same way I started my initial comments by saying, well, on this, the doctrine's pretty clear too, right? You have a constitutional right to burn whatever religious books you want, just like you have the constitutional right to burn flags as long as it doesn't lead to arson. And the government can't stop you from doing that because of the message that will send. That's pretty well established. But, you know, Justice Breyer's comments might reflect a concern that our First Amendment law here might have to be adjusted somewhat if the foreign affairs implications are so grave, and going in both directions. So in that case, it's the free speech rights of the anti-Islamic, the burner, would be restricted so as to promote American foreign policy. But similarly, I just want a couple of the areas in which I'm fearful that the law might start changing. We've mentioned some of them. One is the willingness of courts to allow government officials to take positions on religious truth, and you know, state of Oklahoma saying that their judges cannot invoke Sharia law, and the like. And there was one mention, and I think this will become an issue more in racial profiling and religious profiling in airports and elsewhere. I think will become less sub rosa and more perhaps official policy, and there will be issues associated with that. But I wanted to mention two others that I guess I'm surprised might be open, but I think are. So one is incitement, and not just the person getting up in public or on the internet and saying jihad is a good thing. But I think there's a concern that if we begin to develop insular radicalized religious communities or churches here in the United States, the way Europe has had more exposure to, that the preaching by the leaders of those communities to, you know, if they were to articulate fatwas, or if they were to preach that their congregants should actually go out and commit crimes, I'm afraid there will be more sympathy to the idea that either the Brandenburg test is satisfied in those cases, or that there should be some loosening of that standard. There's a new book by a scholar, Amos Sciorra, that proposes exactly this, and his theory is that these populations are more vulnerable to the religious teachings of their leaders than secular audiences are, because they believe it's religious truth and they have a duty to go out and follow the lead of their religious leaders. And I wonder whether that will push on that doctrine.
And it's worth mentioning in this context too that our U.S. law is exceptionally permissive of speech in these situations.
Right.
So, you know, it's pretty standard affair in most countries, to including countries that take civil liberties somewhat seriously, to arrest people for a religious book, not just on the grounds that it insults, but on the grounds that it incites, when there's nobody in the audience who's about to leap up and do anything.
Right. And the other is one we were discussing over lunch, which is, I guess, the government infiltration of religious communities and churches. It has not been the tradition in the United States, as far as I'm aware, for government, for the FBI or other law enforcement agencies. They've been very, very reluctant to infiltrate themselves into churches, synagogues, and religious communities in particular. But I think to the extent that the government begins to feel as though those communities are being radicalized and they need to gather intelligence and or affect what goes on in those communities, there will be more efforts made to put government officials or government sources and persons within those communities, which will breach a pretty fundamental separation of church and state in a very literal sense that we have enjoyed for a long time. And I wonder whether the courts might be more receptive to that than I would have thought they would have been a while ago.
Dan, I wonder if you would talk about the legal side of the global issues from a civil libertarian standpoint, especially, I mean, a good example that has been in the news is YouTube's decision after pressure to take down videos of Anwar al-Awlaki's speeches and sermons.
What's your view on that as a civil libertarian?
I take a pretty hard line, not surprisingly, on free speech. And it strikes me that if the government is involved in some way in pressuring the removal of speech because it doesn't like the message being sent, I think that's just a clear First Amendment problem.
Even if it's outside the United States?
Even if, you're saying...
Well, imagine the United States government goes to another government. So this is, I think, if, I'm not sure because I'm relying on news reports, but this is how I believe it happened. The U.S. government went, this is the part that's conjecture, and pressured the Yemeni government to bring charges against Awlaki and put him on trial in absentia. They did that. Once that was done, he was under indictment and under trial. There was then grounds under YouTube's international policies for taking down his speech as hate speech that was unlawful in at least one jurisdiction. So this is the United States can make this happen,
right,
without ever violating U.S. law under the doctrinal sense of U.S. law. That's the kind of thing I'm wondering about.
Right. I think it's problematic. I mean, are you going to win a lawsuit on that? I think unlikely. But
should you be able to?
Yeah, I think you should. I also think, getting back to the Establishment Clause problem, I think that the government shouldn't be promoting religion and taking positions on the truth or falsity of any faith here or abroad.
But what about, I mean, this is ideas, right? This is saying there's somebody who's, the U.S. government believes that the things that he is saying are working counter to our national interest, and we can, consistent with our laws as written, go and put pressure on that other country. This is not asking the country to torture him, just to indict him, and because they can't catch him, just indict him and put him on trial and convict him in absentia. We don't do that here, but people do that in a lot of other countries. Is it so obvious that that's a civil, I mean, it limits speech,
but
doesn't limit speech in the United States, arguably.
Right, I'm sure it's not obvious to many people. I have a problem with it. I think it violates the spirit of the First Amendment, just as I would if the government said to the British government, we think someone here has published a really libelous piece about our president, and we can't do anything about it here, but throw him in jail, please. I would have a big problem with that. I think it's similar.
Sam?
On the question you asked about YouTube, Noah, I think...
And by the way, correct me if I've got some of the details wrong there, of how the mechanism.
Well, I don't know that you've gotten the details wrong. I mean, it occurs to me that whatever the government has asked kind of corporate America to do happen within the United States. The servers presumably are being hosted within the United States. So there's an international dimension to it. I wasn't aware until you mentioned it just now that the pressure on the Yemenis to indict was somehow kind of taken in connection with this policy. But let's assume that it was.
Speculation on my part.
Okay, let's assume that it was. All the same, the challenge to speech is obviously taking place among other places in the United States. It's hard to know exactly where the impact of taking these videos down is located in a world in which you get on YouTube anywhere. No, let me get back, though, if I may, to something you said, or to the kind of the general tenor of the question you raised to Marty and to Dan and to others about the kind of the impact of global. We've talked about Yemen into the United States. We've talked about the UK into the United States. I think another aspect of the globalization of these issues has to do with the impact of U.S. activity militarily overseas into U.S. activity domestically. I mean, from my perspective, looking at this issue of the management of Islam, some of it is being learned from British counterparts and from other European counterpart agencies, from Saudis, but a lot of it is actually being imported from the practice of the U.S. national security apparatus in its dealings with Afghans and its dealings with Iraqis and so forth. So there is a sense in which there is a kind of permeation into the United States of activity that we've been undertaking overseas in connection with our kind of national security objectives in the last decade or so. That's another big aspect to this issue.
We have time for a couple of questions from the audience, and it would be a shame to waste that opportunity. Please.
Thank you. Question for Sam Raskoff. You had mentioned counter-radicalization. What role do agent provocateurs fit into that program? It seems like the assumption with ideization intervention is to decrease any potential for radical thought or action, yet you have FBI operatives kind of integrating themselves in situations like the Brooklyn synagogue plot where it was an FBI operative who implanted the idea, encouraged the idea, and then provided the actual tools to carry out the idea for a group of men who wouldn't have the organizational logistical capabilities to do so on their own. It seems like that is a contradiction to the intention of counter-radicalization. I was wondering if you could speak to that and see if that actually undermines any positive intention.
Okay, I think there are a couple of things to say to that. First of all, to make a very kind of broad structural point, I quite agree with your observation that there's a lot of tension between what the government does in the name of counterterrorism in a hard-edged fashion and what the government hopes to achieve through the kind of softer modality of counter-radicalization. So to the extent that the government is perceived as acting without legitimacy in making a criminal case or carrying out a drone attack overseas, that's going to make life more difficult for the government in doing its counter-radicalization work. But I think you were also asking more specifically about the tension within the deployment of an undercover agent or a confidential informant as a kind of agent provocateur. I would say that, yeah, I think the strange phenomenon here is that whereas those sorts of government interventions seem to pass muster under whatever test there is for entrapment in federal criminal cases, nevertheless, I think at the margins, there's actually an interesting question about whether government agents are in fact involved in a sort of management of Islam or a kind of religious intervention that might flunk the Establishment Clause.
Hello, I'm Judy Richheimer. You started to wander into an area that I wish you would revisit, and that has to do with how well the Establishment Clause has actually been respected. And you were suggesting that it's been frayed, and I would argue that the Establishment Clause has never been fully established in this country, and I think that my point of view is that there should be a more vocal and vigorous response to really something that's existed throughout the entire history of our country, money that says in God we trust, one nation under God. And I, returning to the defined nature of this panel, I think that the rights of Muslims would be more respected if we more fully realize that government should not be in the business of religion at all. And although I think the imam probably does work that's much more socially beneficial than a lot of things that NYPD does, I'm sorry, I don't think you or anyone should have a job of chaplain paid for out of my tax dollar.
Anyone want to comment on that? That was more of a comment than a question. So if someone wants to say something, that's fine. But if not, we'll move on to a question. Yes, please.
Can it happen that you hear language which mentions Muslim Americans as Muslims as opposed to Americans? So in a same sentence, like
what's the question?
Sorry, the question is that can it happen that people in public discourse or private conversation talk about Muslim Americans mm-hmm. as sort of only Muslims as opposed to Americans?
I mean, one can see it done. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but of course it's possible. Yeah, you want to speak to that, Howard?
I really wanted to talk about Newt Gingrich, so now's my chance.
Good.
You know, he said
no
something...
No panel at the Center for Law and Security is complete without Newt Gingrich.
So, you know, I'm gonna build on that. I think it's very interesting because I think that, you know, when he said regarding the Ground Zero issue, he basically said, you know, there can't be a mosque here unless there are churches in Mecca. And essentially what's really interesting is most people who responded to that in mainstream discourse said, well, we don't decide our religious policy based on the government of Saudi Arabia's, position in that regard. What nobody really pointed out is that American Muslims are not Saudis. Even if they wanted to have a church in Mecca, to what extent could the Muslim community here have any effect on Saudi Arabian policy? And also, I think the fact that, you know, his marker for Americanness was a church. You know, you can't do this here until we, meaning Americans, have a church there. And I think that's very common in discourse that American Muslims are somehow not Americans. They are, you know, they are a foreign body, they are an invading force, they are a seditious force. Their Islam somehow is so powerful, and goes back to the point previously raised, you know, that it can't be undone. You know, it triumphs over everything. You can't rationalize Muslims. You can't civilize Muslims. You just have to manage them.
I think it also makes it a lot. I mean, to say to what you're saying, to refer as just as Muslims or qualifying the kind of Islam allows for a lot more facility to kind of see the community as being monolithic, right? And something that definitely is homogenous. And you know, going back to what you were saying, kind of a racialization of the faith, where people are actually discussing, you know, they see Islam more as an ethnicity than anything else. Where even if people convert into Islam, they've suddenly lost whatever privilege they were kind of getting prior to their conversion, because now they've joined this huge monolithic, like a lump of individuals, where it becomes hard to distinguish between Muslims who are in the United States and Muslims who are in Saudi Arabia and Muslims who are in Indonesia. You know, everybody's just Muslim. And at that point, it's a lot easier to also kind of infringe on the rights of Muslims, because we only see them, you know, as kind of this one entity, as opposed to this really diverse population, which they actually are.
That raises, I mean, I think that your point, Khalid, raises a really important issue, which we haven't actually spoken about, but is worth mentioning, which is even the formulation Muslim Americans is a formulation that's ordinarily used in the United States, blank hyphen Americans. It's usually used in an ethnic capacity rather than a religious capacity. So one doesn't say Catholic Americans. It's quite unusual. One never sees hyphenated Catholic Americans or Protestant hyphen Americans or Buddhist hyphen Americans, right? The confusion arises, if it is a confusion, from the use of the term Jewish American, which, by the way, was very controversial in the American Jewish community for the course of 25 or 30 years, because of the phenomenon of the Jewish community in the United States being both a religious community and an ethnic community simultaneously. So the presence of that simultaneity introduced, I think, historically, this ambiguity into the question. And then one result of that, as you say, is that unlike the situation for Catholics, who are understood to belong to many ethnicities, so you can have Italian Americans who happen to be Catholic, and Irish Americans who happen to be Catholic, and German Americans who happen to be Catholic, and no one assumes that their hyphenated Americanness is their religion, and the assumption is that it's their ethnicity. There's a kind of falling away of that Imam Khalid is talking about in this context. So arguably, it would be preferable. I mean, your question implied that saying just Muslims is a bad thing. But arguably, on this view, Imam Khalid's view, it would be better to say American Muslims, not Muslim Americans. And then if you're talking about particular people in their ethnicity, you could say Pakistani American or, you know, Egyptian American or none of the above. So it's not clear to me that the term Muslim American in this context is doing it good. It's a complicated thing. So it's not an obvious thing in light of your comments.
I mean, it's definitely complicated. And, you know, I think what it does is, you know, the ability to make it monolithic also makes it a lot easier to craft a narrative that kind of fits into certain agendas, right? But if you have to deal with a diverse population, you also have to deal with a diversity of narrative that doesn't allow for you to kind of infringe on people's rights individually, because you're now kind of crossing a multitude of cultures. I don't know if that makes sense or not. So for example, you know, if I see Islam as something that's always outside of where I'm at right now, you know, in the process I deny this deep, rich history of an African-American Islam that's been here for a long time. And at the same time, it kind of makes it very, you know, it kind of further emphasizes the foreignness, and it makes it very intangible to a population that doesn't have a narrative on what Islam actually represents, which is something that doesn't represent one thing. It represents many different things to many people. And it makes it a lot easier to say, you know, statements such as Mr. Gingrich makes, that Islam is X, Y, or Z thing. And people then believe it because they only see Islam as being one thing, and it can't be like many things. Yeah.
Well, could we pull ourselves back to, and I think Harun made this point before, when a religion is considered, and you know, to be part of a mainstream America, and the Supreme Court, especially in its Establishment Clause jurisprudence, has been collapsing Americanism into Christian religious symbols, whether it's a cross memorializing veterans of different faiths and saying, well, this is a universal symbol, or mm-hmm. the much abused term Judeo-Christian, which doesn't really mean anything. It tends to be the recourse of people who want to talk about this being a Christian nation, they go, oh, no, I meant, you know, Judeo-Christian. But, you know, in the same manner in which Catholicism was an alien strain in the United States and then became mainstreamed in the United States, you know, we're looking now at this notion of a Muslim community being a foreign entity and dealt with in that way. So.
Thank you. I hope you all join me in thanking the panelists for a really wonderful conversation.
Before we leave, I just want to say you've been wonderful. It's been a very long day. I think you have enough food for thought for a year, but we'll have you back before that. I want to point out that there were three children here all day long listening to this, and I think nothing could make me happier. Thank you very much for